This mini-lecture for English 206 Literary History focuses on Samuel Taylor Coleridge and Sir Walter Scott as two of the first major Romantic writers to take up medieval subjects in some of their most important poetry. I'm going to begin with Scott, who is most famous today as a novelist, but made his first reputation as a poet. One of the remarkable things about Scott is that he had a very successful career as a poet and later as a novelist, something that's very rarely done in literature. Usually somebody has one specialty or the other, and if they write in another form, it's thought of as somewhat secondary to what they do. For Scott, he was famous for works like The Lay of the Last Minstrel, Marmion, The Lady of the Lake, that recycled Scottish history, Arthurian legends, stories of castles and knights and ladies in distress. And at the same time, he was also very much involved in antiquarian research, trying to recreate some of the old texts that maybe had not been translated yet out of Latin or out of older, say, Gaelic or earlier dialects of English. And after working in those antiquarian and poetic fields for a number of years, Scott began writing novels, starting with his novel Waverley in 1814. Scott was so embarrassed by writing novels because they were seen as not nearly as high class as book-length poems at that point, which he'd been used to writing. Marmion, Lady of the Lake, Lay of the Last Minstrel are all book-length poems. They might be described as epics. Until very late in his life, Scott refused to put his name on the novels that he published, despite the fact that these are some of the most famous things that he ever wrote. Works like Ivanhoe, Rob Roy, The Heart of Midlothian. Some of these kinds of works have been turned into films. They've been reprinted for centuries at this point. And I believe it's significant that Scott, despite being more famous for the fiction rather than the poetry, keeps largely the same subject matter regardless of which genre he's in. He's focused on the Middle Ages. He's focused on the past that is far enough back that people aren't entirely sure what happened. That gives him room to invent. That gives him room to imagine a different way of life, a different set of values. As a Scot who is dealing with British imperial policies, the treatment of Scotland that his country is receiving from England at the time. He's living through an era of pretty serious crackdown, in fact, on Scotland in the wake of some rebellions in the 1700s. England has really cut off a lot of the Scottish economy. Scott helps to revitalize that and to start to create a tourist economy in Scotland by writing these medieval works. So it's interesting also that the medieval material is tied in with this idea that you can go visit these ruins and imagine what it was like for knights like Marmion and Lochinvar to be riding across these pastures. Turning to Coleridge, Coleridge is English. He was Cambridge educated, in fact, and he was one of the most well-read members of his generation. He was fluent in Latin and Greek. He was also fluent in German. He had actually studied at Göttingen for a little while in northern Germany. And he was one of the first English writers to start to absorb what we would call Romantic philosophy. He was very interested in Kant, one of the very first English writers to be interested in Immanuel Kant's philosophy. He was interested in Hegel. He was interested in the Schlegel brothers, who were writing about literature. They were writing about what it means to be an individual in modern life, how that compares to earlier times. They would talk about the difference between primitive and sentimental poetry. And Coleridge was very interested in playing with that divide. Is there a way to get back to an earlier kind of poetry using modern techniques? Both Rime of the Ancient Mariner and Christabel are participating in that kind of larger project that he's interested in. We'll begin with Rime of the Ancient Mariner. The version that we're reading was written in 1797. This is very early in Coleridge's career. He's only a few years out of college at this point. And he's writing with his friend William Wordsworth. They're starting to assemble what they're thinking of as a volume of lyrical ballads. This is often thought of as a watershed collection in the history of Romantic literature. What's weird for people in 1800, when the book finally comes out, about lyrical ballads is that you're supposed to either have poems that tell stories, those are ballads, or you have poems that pause on a certain idea or image or moment and reflect on it. That's a lyric. Think of something like, for instance, Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn. That's a lyric. You just sit and look at the urn, compared to something like Scott's Lochinvar, where the knight is riding up to the castle. He's going to kidnap the lady and whisk her off into the night. That's a ballad. Wordsworth and Coleridge were convinced that you could put these two things together. You could have a poem that told a story and paused on a crucial moment all at the same time. And Rime of the Ancient Mariner is one of the poems that tries to do that more toward the ballad end of the spectrum. Even the meter is taken from old ballad forms. It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three. That kind of ba-bump, ba-bump, ba-bump meter that it follows is something that you can find in the Ballad of Sir Patrick Spens, all kinds of ballads that are starting to show up in Percy's Relics, as well as the kinds of things that you see Robert Burns publishing out of Scotland a generation before, trying to bring folklore into the mainstream of literature. When Coleridge writes Rime of the Ancient Mariner, one thing we can notice about that 1797 version is that the spelling is really odd. It looks like Rime of the Ancient Mariner, or we might even bring it back to an earlier English pronunciation, Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And that's exactly what Coleridge was going for. He was trying to use spellings and vocabulary in that poem that were common about 300 years before he was writing. So he's writing in the 1790s. He's thinking back to the 1490s. This is back right at the end of, say, the Wars of the Roses, the beginning of the Tudor era, 100 years before Shakespeare. So this would have been archaic language even by the time Shakespeare was alive. That's what he wants to reach back to tell the story of the Ancient Mariner. And the character of the Ancient Mariner itself is based on a very old medieval legend that's told all over Europe, which is referred to as the legend of the Wandering Jew. There is this tradition that a Jewish man in Jerusalem, the day that Christ was being crucified, came out to see the procession out to where the crucifixion was going to happen. And as Christ came by, he asked for relief, a drink of water, one version says, or maybe something to wipe his forehead, and the man spat on him. He completely rejected him. And so the tradition goes, because he rejected Christ at that crucial moment, he was forever condemned to wander the earth as an immortal. He would never be allowed to die, and he would never be allowed to stop until he had explained to everyone in the world who it is that he had seen and what he had seen on that day. So the Wandering Jew would just travel from place to place through the centuries, telling the story of the crucifixion. The Ancient Mariner similarly is traveling from town to town, and who knows how long he's been at it, telling people about the experience that he had killing the albatross and what happened in the wake of that. Interestingly enough, Coleridge returns to this poem about 20 years later, 1817. He publishes a new version of it where he's standardized and modernized the spelling. He's cleaned a lot of that up. But one thing that he adds in that new version is he starts to put these glosses, these little explanations of what's happening in the plot along the margins of what's showing up in the original poem. So you have the column of poetry, and off to the side of it, you have these little prose comments telling you what the key moments are. Sometimes they're not exactly what the poetry would tell. It's almost as if it's starting to tell a new story. And that convention of having the glosses in the margins is taken directly out of medieval manuscript culture. So once he reaches the point where he makes his language less medieval, he actually makes the form of the poem on the page more medieval. So what counts as medieval for Coleridge is actually a pretty complicated question. Turning to Christabel, it gets even more complicated, if that's possible. One of the curious things about Christabel is that he writes it around the same time as Rime of the Ancient Mariner. He chooses not to include it in lyrical ballads, and he actually takes, again, about 20 years to publish it. He writes one part of it in about 1797. He writes another piece of it around 1800, and Then he stops with it and he keeps toying with different ideas of how to finish the poem. And he never gets around to finishing the poem. Some people will read just part one as a poem in and of itself, but it's clear that the story hasn't resolved by that point. Then you can include part two. The story still hasn't resolved by that point. And Coleridge imagined a redemptive end where good would triumph over evil, that possibly even Christabel would wind up redeeming Geraldine, that Geraldine would wind up turning from being some sort of evil spirit or evil woman to being a force for good in the world. Another option was that Christabel would be utterly destroyed by Geraldine. Coleridge never worked out which one he really wanted to do, and he never wrote the part three that he continually talked about and brainstormed about throughout the rest of his career. He lived into the 1830s and never completed this. But there are a couple of things about Christabel that I think are important to consider in light of this medievalism. One is that this is very clearly written in the Gothic tradition. The Gothic does not have to have a medieval setting, but a medieval setting lends itself to it. One of the reasons why Gothic literature is called that is because Gothic-style castles were often the locations where these things would happen. For instance, the Castle of Otranto, some of the other kinds of castles that would show up in Horace Walpole or Anne Radcliffe novels of the late 1700s were kind of the foundational texts of modern British Gothic literature, leading into things like Frankenstein by Mary Shelley in the 18-teens, and on leading to things like Bram Stoker's Dracula very late in the 1800s. When Coleridge is writing in the Gothic mode, he's interested in that supernatural element that just seems to inhere in the medieval era, particularly in medieval spaces. The castle space is very important in this poem, and the mysterious places where you can cross thresholds and hide people away in dark corners is very important in this kind of work. One other thing that is important here is the fact that Christabel is a fragment. It is not a completed work. And the fragment and the ruin are two tropes that continually come up over and over again as people write about medieval history, as medieval tourism, or at least tourism around places associated with the medieval, begin to rise, where you go to see ruins. Think of, for instance, Wordsworth's famous poem about visiting Tintern Abbey. He's visiting a ruined Gothic-style monastery from the Middle Ages in Wales. And as Coleridge is working with this idea of something that is left incomplete or something that seems to be falling down around him, the architecture of the poem being incomplete mimics some of these ruins or some of these uncompleted buildings that are left standing, sometimes referred to as follies, that people would return to as tourist sites. So Coleridge, as well as Scott, is very deeply invested in the aesthetics, but also in some way the psychology, maybe even the politics of the Middle Ages, allowing him to explore these ideas of redemption and power and morality in ways that take him out of the modern world, but yet are very much of the modern moment.